Okay. Good afternoon. So today, to start out, I'd like to make a note about the final. It's on the 13th of December at 7 p.m. That's on the schedule. If you can't make that, there's a form to submit to ask for a conflict time, and please do that, and do that sooner rather than like just before the exam, so we can actually give you an exam at the time, a time you can take it. Okay, so with that out of the way, let's go on to today's topic, where we're going to talk about exceptions and processes. And as a piece of motivation, I'm going to start with an infinite loop. So here's a perfectly valid C program that I could compile and run. And let's say I compiled this and ran it on LabYourNextOne. Let's say that machine only had one core. Would you still be able to use the machine? So who thinks, yeah, I would be able to? So most people think you can, and that's right. The machine still is usable to you, even though I'm doing something which, the way we've learned about processors working, there's no way for anything else to happen. If this is going to turn into a jump to the same instruction, that's going to keep executing forever. There's no chance for anything else to happen. As from the processor you've built, there's no way for anything else to be running on that single core. And maybe we can investigate this further and look at executing a loop and just how long it takes to do nothing. So here's some code. I don't have an infinite loop just so I can output a finite list of numbers, not an infinite one. But I'm going to execute a loop, do absolutely nothing, and see how long that takes. So I'm looking at a clock, storing the value I look at, then looking at a clock again, and looking at the difference, and looking at what that is. And on the machine you built for the pipe homework, you'd expect this to take basically the same amount of time. There's not any access to memory, and that's pretty much the only reason we had why instructions could take different amounts of time, different times you execute them. So ignore, as long as the instruction cache has all these instructions, which it definitely should. This is a very small program. We expect the same difference every single time. But if we actually run this program, we get some outliers. So most of the time, I measure basically the same difference. This around number, this is in nanoseconds, and this is a log scale. So this number around like 50, 60 nanoseconds. But some of the time, I get 10 to the 7 nanoseconds, so several milliseconds, millions of cycles. So what's happening when it takes me millions of cycles to do nothing? So what I'm getting is it looks like I have the CPU, I'm running my program, and then nothing is happening for a long time, and then my program's running again. And even if we look at the assembly, what might be happening is we call our function to read the clock. That does something magical. Then we store the value we just read. And then somehow executing this move queue seems to take a million cycles. And then we do our next call and so on. And so there's this big gap in there. And what actually happens is the reason why you didn't think me running my infinite loop on the lab machines would cause a problem, that other programs get to run, that we actually have other things happening on the machine that get a chance to use the machine. So if there are other things to run, this million cycle delay is where they're running. So somehow, my loop program has the CPU here and here, but in between, other things get to use the CPU. And I don't notice. It looks like this executes just the way we executed assembly instructions when you're a simulated processor, except sometimes it takes a long time. And doing this switching between programs, I'm calling time multiplexing. And by doing this, we get to share a processor between multiple programs, but give each program the illusion that they have their own dedicated processor. The only reason I knew that there was this million cycle delay here is because I was looking at the time, because I'm looking at performance. If I don't care about performance, everything is operating correctly. Something else running and using RAX doesn't mean that I lost the value I had in RAX or in RBP. This subtraction still has the right values for all the registers, even though something else was running in this million cycle delay here. So as far as I'm concerned, from correctness, I have dedicated registers and all those other things which are an essential part of the CPU, all to myself. It's just sometimes the performance is not very good. And this is called a thread. So this illusion of a dedicated processor, this abstraction where we give you what looks like a dedicated processor, which may or may not map to a real processor one-to-one. Sometimes you'll have multiple threads. In this case, we had three threads using the same processor. But each one program thinks it has its own dedicated processor. And the illusion is perfect from a correctness perspective. The performance is not the same as a real dedicated processor, but from a correctness perspective, there's absolutely no way to know you don't have a real processor. You don't see other programs doing things that change the answer you get. So how does this time multiplexing work? Something actually needs to change between running one thread and another. And that's going to be part of the job of the operating system. So at each of these transitions where I just said we switch from one program to the other, actually we're going to spend a little bit of time running the operating system. And the operating system is going to peek under the covers. It's going to know that everyone doesn't really have a dedicated processor. And it's going to implement that abstraction. And we call the thing which makes the operating system start running an exception. So that's when an exception is going to be how we're going to stop our infinite loop from running and make the operating system start running. That's going to be something the processor implements, because there's nothing in the instructions the processor is running otherwise that would let the operating system run. And when the operating system does what we call returning from the exception, it's going to have the option of changing to another thread. And the operating system is going to be responsible for setting up what other thread runs. So in this case, the operating system chose not to keep running loop.exe, but to switch to ssh.exe. So to implement this, we have this mechanism that the hardware needs to give us, where we can be running normal instructions and somehow, instead of running a normal program, we start running the operating system. And that's going to be what exceptions are going to do. And somehow, we need to save where we were in the program. We need to remember what the old program counter was, and the hardware is going to need to help with that, because if we just start running the operating system, we just jump to operating system code, we've forgotten what the program counter is. Do something like what we do in a function call and store that old program counter somewhere so we can actually keep running the loop.exe again. So the operating system needs to also save the register somewhere in order to switch to a new program, because eventually it wants to switch back to loop.exe. And it's going to be the part of the job of the operating system to remember the value we had in RBP and so on, so that when it switches back, we actually end up giving the correct answer to all the instructions we have afterwards. And for the whatever new program it's running, it needs to take its old save registers that happened in another exception and put them back in the real registers of the machine and somehow jump to that program counter that it saved. And this whole event here is called a context switch. And the saved information, those registers and that program counter the operating system is using to remember where it was in the exception and to come back there, is called a context. So context It's going to have all the register values. So RAX, RBP, RBX, RSP, all the condition codes, and the program counter. So it's all the state that's visible to programs running on your, say, pipeline processor. All the state that the programs could see. And what the code for this looks kind of something like is that we somehow copy our, have some special way of getting at wherever the hardware saved the program counter that the exception happened at, and we save that somewhere, and then we save all the registers, which is just moving them to some location in memory, for example, and then we restore all the registers of whatever we want to run next, and restore its saved PC that we stored earlier. So one way of thinking about this is that when we're running process A, we have the context for process A, it just is stored in the CPU. And there's some programs we aren't running. So if process A is loop, then say ssh.exe is not running right now. But we still have its context stored somewhere, and that's going to be in the operating system's memory. And since process A is running on the CPU, it has memory allocated, and some things in its context actually point to that memory. So it has a stack pointer, and that points to its memory. It has a program counter, and that points somewhere in its memory while it's running. And at some point, the OS gets to run, and it's going to take this context here that it has stored in memory and move it onto the CPU, and also move what was on the CPU into its memory. So it's going to swap the two programs. One's going to, that was on the CPU before, goes in memory, and vice versa. And now we're running process B, and its registers are pointing to its memory, and it's running as if it was. So questions, comments on how these context switches work? So I have this picture of where we store context. So let's talk about something else that I might try to do with multiple programs on a machine. So here's an example of two programs. So we have program A, which is storing a value in its static data at a fixed address, the number 42. And at some point, very late in the program, we read that value into RAX. Let's say, you know, we know what address this is. Let's say in some other program, I try to take 99 and write it into that address. So what's likely to happen if I do this? What would happen if I ran this program, this pair of programs on a lab machine? Yes. Segfault. So what would segfault?
Try to access a file number that wasn't part of that program's section.
Yeah. So you're going to say that somehow, when program B is accessing this address, that's not its address because we know it's program A's address, and it's going to give us a segmentation fault, which you've probably seen before because you've written some sort of C++ program that accessed something out of the bounds of an array or a pointer you deleted or something like that. So you've seen that behavior where you access memory you don't own, and sometimes you get this segmentation fault. What's going to happen in program A then? So program A, therefore, since if program B can't write to its memory, could always get 42. It's never going to see another value. So, and that's sort of the results I have. But it's a little more complicated than that. So this program here, it's writing to address 10,000. So that might crash. Program A will always get the answer 42. It's not going to see whatever program B does. But I only say might crash. So there's something else going on here. So our notion here is that it looks like this address must be owned by program A. But if you remember, I showed you something, a picture of how programs are laid out in memory earlier in the semester. And there's something that should seem funny to you if you think about running multiple programs by switching, taking turns on a processor. So this is the picture I showed. And I said, well, at address 40,000, just that fixed address for every single program, that's where our code goes. At this address here, 7F and something, that's where our stack goes. We just have these fixed addresses that are the same for every program. So if we have two programs, they have code at the same address and writable data at the same address and the stack at the same place, yet they don't interfere with each other. So it's not the case that address 10,000 belongs to program A and not program B. Each program has their own idea of what their addresses are. So somehow we're giving programs the illusion that they own all this memory and that whatever address they want is reserved for them. So program A has its own code at address 40,000. Program B has its own code there. And if it tries to read from that address, it's never going to read from the other program. So this is called an address space. And like we had the illusion of a dedicated processor, we also have the illusion of a dedicated memory. So each program has the illusion that they have their own memory, that the data and instruction memory that they're executing with is only used for them, just like the rest of the processor and its registers looks like it's only used for them. And just like with the processor, the only way the program's going to see these effects is from performance, or if it does things it's not accesses memory that doesn't exist as far as it's concerned. And the way this is going to be implemented is going to be by setting a mapping from the addresses that appear in the program, like that 10,000, to actual real memory addresses. And that's going to be configured by the OS. And Luther will talk a lot more about that next week. It's a very involved topic. We could, conceptually, we could do this by every time we switch between programs, we could copy to the memory, copy the code of the program that we're about to run to address 40,000 and not have this mapping. But that would be very slow. So instead, our processor is going to support setting up these mappings. And by switching the mapping, we switch the address space we're running with. We switch what address 40,000, what piece of code that is, whether that's program A's code or program B's code. And as we alluded to earlier, there are cases where when you try to access memory that you don't own, you get some sort of segmentation fault. And that's these holes here. We have these regions of memory, these addresses, which don't have any mapping. And those are the regions where if your program tries to access it, it's going to cause a it's going to cause that error. And this is going to be part of our mapping. So in addition to the mapping being able to say, this part is program A, goes to this piece of real memory, the mapping can also say some addresses should trigger an error. So the operating system can request that if the program tries to access this address, don't access a real memory address, just trigger an error that I, the operating system, will handle. And that's what's happening when you get a segmentation fault. Is that it's one of these regions where the operating system said, this is not a valid region of memory to access. So the mechanism for this, yes, sorry.
Do the addresses that are available to a program change during its execution?
Yes, and we will discuss that a little bit more later. So the general mechanism of having these mappings is called virtual memory. And the mapping itself, that data structure, is going to be called a page table. And this mapping is one of the things we're going to want to change during a context switch. So in addition to changing the registers and the program counter, we're also going to change what this mapping is. So that changes our notion of what a context is. So in addition to having all the register values and the condition code and the program counter, all the user visible state that's in the CPU itself, we also change the address space, which is conceptually what the memories are. We change what that mapping is every time we do a context switch, along with changing all the registers. So when we combine these notion of a thread, this illusion of a dedicated processor, and this notion of an address space, which gives us the illusion of a dedicated memory, what we get is called a process. So a process is one or more threads and an address space. So that's the thing the operating system maintains, and it looks kind of like a dedicated machine. Every program seems to be running on its own dedicated machine with its own CPU and memory. But the reality is that it's sharing the machine, the CPUs, and the memory with lots of other programs. But as far as it's concerned, as far as how you program, you program it like you have your own machine all to yourself. So questions, comments about this idea of what a process is? Yes?
What's the difference between a thread and a process?
So a thread is just the part where we have a separate CPU. So a process, for example, can have multiple threads, which means that you have the same memory, but multiple virtual CPUs. So two threads will have the CPUs chugging along on instructions at the same time, but they'll access the same memory space. So this distinction comes up if you hear about multi-threaded programming. For the rest of today and Thursday, we'll just be talking about single-threaded processes. So we'll just be talking about processes as both. Yes?
So multi-threaded programming is still running sequentially?
So each thread, which is a virtual CPU, so there's multiple CPUs the program thinks it has, and they might map to multiple real CPUs. So I've given you a picture where we have one CPU because I want to keep things simple, but everything that I talk about happening on one CPU happens separately on each of the several cores you have on a multi-core machine. It's the same thing, it just happens separately for each core. In a multi-threaded program, we just give the program the illusion it has multiple cores to itself, and those cores might map to one CPU or one real core or multiple real cores. It's up to the OS and what machine you actually have. So that's our notion of a process. And the way, before we got here, I mentioned we had this idea of an exception, which is our key way of being able to maintain this illusion that you have a dedicated processor and still let other programs actually run. That this exception let the OS actually start running. So let's talk about what exceptions are in general. So they're a special kind of control transfer. So they're basically, they act like a function call, except that unlike a function call, they might not have been requested by the program. If we look at our loop example, there's nothing about this move queue instruction which says, please run the operating system. But that happens anyways. So some exceptions will be basically requested by the program, but it's not required. It can happen completely independently of the program saying anything about running the OS in some location. And it transfers control from a user program, usually, to the OS. And the example we've seen so far is something from like a timer expiring. So that's the most common way to guarantee that my infinite loop doesn't run forever. The OS will set up a timer with the processor to be triggered some amount of time after it starts running that program. So it will get an exception. That means that it can say, I don't want this program running more than a millisecond, so it sets a timer for a millisecond from now, and then a millisecond later, the OS starts running and can stop that infinite loop from running and let someone else use the actual real CPU. And our book has this big taxonomy of exceptions. And one of the high-level categories are interrupts. So interrupts mean something that is externally triggered. And a timer is an example of that. There's nothing in my infinite loop program which triggers the timer. It's completely outside my program. Another very important category of interrupts are from I/O devices. When I press a key, we often want something to happen as a result. And consequently, that's the case where we have an exception. An interrupt will happen. So the operating system can decide, what should I do about this key press? And can, for example, if I have a program that's waiting for me to type something, it might decide to start running that program because I pressed a key. This also comes up with all sorts of other I/O devices, like when a hard drive has data, that might cause an interrupt to happen so the operating system can run and do something with that data. And when a network card has data or is ready to send something, that will trigger an interrupt so the operating system can run and communicate with the network card. So we saw our timer interrupt, where we have a, at least conceptually, external timer device, which lets the OS set a time limit on programs and get a signal at some point. We also saw an example of the second category our book has, which are faults. So faults are exceptions, transfers of control to the OS, triggered by errors or other sorts of events in programs. And the example we saw was we accessed memory that wasn't in the program's address space. What Linux reflects as a segmentation fault. So, we tried to write about address, and what the processor does with that is it runs the OS. It transfers control to the OS, and the OS gets to decide what to do. Typically, what the OS does, as far as we've seen, is it will just crash the program and give you a message. And this is the mechanism by which it gets to run, because when we write a move queue instruction that moves to an invalid memory address, there's nothing about that which says call a function in that instruction. So this is set up on the processor globally. And the OS also has options of doing something other than just crashing the program. And next week, we'll see a few examples of that. So our book divides exceptions into two categories, and these are probably more universal than the division of exceptions into the four broad categories. So some exceptions are synchronous. When we say an exception is synchronous, that means we mean it's triggered by a particular instruction. The instruction might not have said to call the operating system, but because of that instruction, we had an exception happen. The example is a move instruction that moves to an invalid memory address. That gives us a synchronous exception, our protection fault accessing a bad address, and it's triggered by that running that particular instruction. So part of running that instruction is that instead of writing back its result, the processor is going to run the operating system. We also have asynchronous exceptions, and those are things which come from outside the program, like our timer event and all our interrupts. And this distinction is useful because what the operating system wants to do for these two categories of exceptions is very different. For a synchronous thing, you're going to want to do something with the program. For example, you really care for a synchronous exception, what instruction triggered this? That's something that matters. For an asynchronous one, you probably don't care. You might want to store it somewhere so you can switch back to the program later, but you aren't actually going to be looking at that instruction. That's not important. So these are handled very differently in practice in operating systems. Okay, so we've talked about kinds of exceptions and some ways the operating system uses exceptions to do useful things to processes. Let's talk about how the exception is actually going to be implemented in the hardware. So the hardware has three steps it really needs to do to handle exceptions. So the first thing is that somehow it needs to detect that an exception happened. So in the case of a program error, like an illegal instruction or accessing an invalid memory address, this is going to be part of the instruction execution. It's part of the execution will say, oh, that opcode is invalid, or that memory address wasn't in the mapping when I checked. My memory gave me a signal saying no. In the case of an external event, we're going to have wires coming into the processor that are going to be checked on certain instructions, and that's going to trigger this exception handling code. And one thing we need to do before we start running the OS is we need to save the current program counter somewhere. It would be really bad if we set the timer to interrupt a program so we can restart it later if we forgot where it was. And as soon as we change the PC, if we don't have it stored elsewhere, we would have forgotten that. So the hardware needs to save the program counter somewhere. There's lots of options that real hardware uses to do this. You could put it in memory, you can put it in the special register, but you need to save a copy of it somewhere so the operating system knows where to go back on something like a timer interrupt. And then finally, you jump to the exception handler. And this is basically just like a normal jump. You just start executing instructions from whatever the address of the instruction handler is. You just set the PC to that and execute instructions as usual. So it's just like a jump, except there's no instruction in the program telling us to do the jump. So I'll note before I go into more detail about how exception implementation works that I'm giving, and the textbook gives, a simplified version. So the real x86 exception handling has a bunch of extra steps that aren't really important and mostly are there for historical reasons. But if you actually look up the documentation, you might find this confusing that I'm omitting a lots of steps and like x86 does a bunch of extra stuff that processors don't really need to do. Just letting you know. So one step we need here is we need to somehow know where to jump to. And the way that typically works is that we have a special register telling us where to look up where to jump to. And this is going to be called an exception table base register. And that's going to be a pointer to a table in memory that is a list of pointers telling us what to do for each kind of exception. So let's say exception kind 0 is divide by 0. We're going to have a pointer to the operating system's divide by 0 handler. And if exception kind 8 is timer interrupt, we're going to have a pointer at the appropriate index of the table to the code which handles a timer interrupt. So we'll have this table filled out by the operating system, and then the operating system will execute a special instruction to set the exception table base register to point to this table. And then on an exception, the processor will look up the appropriate entry of this table and use that value as the PC. And so once the hardware has done that and saved the old program counter, the OS can do all the other work it needs to do in the exception. So the typical structure you'll see in an exception handler is you'll start out by saving whatever process was running when the exception happened state somewhere. This is going to even be true in cases where we keep running that process again, because the OS needs space to do work. Just like when you have a function, you're going to save some registers around so you have registers to work with. So the OS needs to do the same thing. So typically, we'll start by saving the process's state somewhere for later. Then we're going to do whatever work we're supposed to do to handle the exception. So for a timer interrupt, that work is going to be figuring out what process we want to run next. And then we're going to restore some process's state. Possibly the same process that triggered the exception, possibly not. But before we leave the exception handler, we're going to restore some process's state. And then we're going to jump back to the program. And usually, for reasons we'll discuss later, there's a special instruction for jumping back to the program. One obvious reason, that's probably not the main reason that we have this, is that we want a special instruction for this because we don't want to use any registers to store where we jump back to because the program might have been using them. It's not an obvious place to put it besides some special location. So having a special instruction for that will be helpful. So any questions on sort of this workflow? Exception handler? Yes.
Could you just explain the last part again?
So usually we'll have a special instruction to return from the exception. We'll talk more later about things that does which are different than a normal jump. But one reason to have that is we want to have a place to store the new PC that isn't going to be used by the program we interrupted. Because the program can't pop, we can't use any normal register for that at the least, because the program expects those all to be the same when we start running it again as when we interrupted it.
Okay, so the instruction following where we interrupted?
Yeah. Okay, so to implement this, we need to add some new logic to our processor. So we have a new instruction to set the exception table base and the register that that sets that we need to add to our processor. We have this new logic in the processor to actually read an entry from the exception table and do a jump based on that. And we have this new logic to save the old program counter so the operating system can read it and jump back to it later. And we have a new instruction to return from an exception that we've added. So when we combine all that, we get a better picture of what was going on in our original time slicing example. So my infinite loop was running, and then a timer interrupt happened, that particular kind of exception. And that happened because before my infinite loop started running, the operating system configured a timer to trigger an external event and send a signal to the processor saying, hey, you should interrupt this. You should run the OS now. And that caused the processor to do a lookup in that exception table. And from that, it found, hey, I want to run this code here, which the OS called handle timer interrupt. And when that code finishes executing, it switches the address space to SSH instead of loop, and uses SSH save program counter, and returns from the exception, but instead of returning into loop, it returns into SSH. People look kind of confused or something. Questions? Comments? Yeah?
Are these things run as their own processes with the OS handler?
So the OS isn't really a process, just because it knows about, because it does the switching. But all of these programs are their own processes. Especially since we're switching address spaces and the program counter. So one thing you might wonder is, well, the operating system set up how to handle this timer exception. Why can't I do that myself? Why can't I write a better infinite loop program? You know, and instead of having my program be interrupted by this timer interrupt and letting other people use the machine that I really want to hog all the time of, why can't I just set my own exception table base? And I have this nice exception table where I have my own timer interrupt handler, which is a lot simpler than the OS is, much more efficient. It just returns immediately without changing anything right back to where we were. So should this work? Yes? No? Any people think it probably shouldn't work? It'd be pretty bad if this worked. Not nice if I could just hog the lab machine by doing this. So what's going to happen if I try? Yes?
It's a privileged command, so you're going to get a fault.
Yeah, so it's privileged. So if I, for example, here's that LIDT is the instruction to just set the exception table base register on x86. If I try to run that with a correctly set up exception table, I'm going to get a segmentation fault, just like accessing invalid memory. So it's a privileged instruction. And this is because we can't just let any program decide what happens on a timer interrupt. That would defeat what we're trying to let our operating system do. So we have a way of not letting programs run some instructions. And this allows us to safely share things like LabUnix 1 between multiple users without worrying about someone running a very small and simple program that uses this, all the CPU forever and requires the machine to reboot it. So some examples of privileged instructions are setting the exception table, setting the address space. So why do we need the setting the address space to be a privileged instruction? Yeah. Yeah, so for example, if you're writing something in a text editor, if I could set my address space, I could read what you're writing by choosing the real addresses of that your text editor is using. So that'd be very bad. I could also set my address space to include where the exception handler is and write to it. Should also be bad. The same effect as changing the exception table, basically. Also, talking to I/O devices. So generally, the operating system is going to be the only entity that's allowed to talk to I/O devices. So for something like a hard drive, this is how we know that you can access files, but at the least, you can't access any file, that there's permissions that are enforced. This is also going to be true with things like the keyboard or the display. Generally, these will be privileged instructions, and ordinary programs will not be able to access these devices. And the implementation strategy that lets this happen is the processor is going to have two modes it can run in. So there's one mode called kernel mode. And this is what the operating system runs in to do all these privileged instructions. And in that mode, the privileged instructions work. There's also user mode. In user mode, the privileged instructions instead cause an exception to happen. Just like accessing a bad memory address. So the implementation of this in the processor is actually pretty simple. We're going to have an extra 1-bit register that's going to say, are we in kernel mode or not? And on these privileged instructions, as part of executing them in our pipeline, we're going to look at that register. And depending on what it is, we're either going to actually do what the instruction is supposed to do, or we're going to trigger an exception. Now, one thing we need is we need a way to start running in kernel mode and to stop running in kernel mode, to start running in user mode. And the mechanism we will have for that is when we have an exception, we'll switch to kernel mode. So the operating system, when it handles its timer interrupt and needs to change the address space to run another program, it's going to be in kernel mode, so it can do that. And when it returns from an exception, it's going to leave kernel mode. And this is one of the other things that return from exception instruction is going to do for us. It's going to switch from kernel mode to user mode. So in addition to jumping to the appropriate place in the user program without using a register, we're going to also switch back to unprivileged mode at the same time. And so this mechanism means that exceptions are the only way programs have to get at privileged instructions. So the only way a privileged instruction is going to run is if an exception happens that causes a privileged instruction to run. Just user programs doing normal things are never going to be able to actually complete a privileged instruction. So questions about kernel mode? So speaking of what the operating system does, if you remember from this picture of our memory layout of programs, we had this suspicious region at the top of memory and the Linux configuration of memory, where we have memory that's labeled as used by the OS. So this large area of memory. And this is where things like the exception handlers are and the exception table. Because we want those in the address space so the processor can switch the PC and run them. But it would be pretty bad if we could just write to that from a user program, because we're not supposed to be able to write to an exception handler And we wouldn't care about having the set exception table base register instruction being privileged if we can just modify the exception table that's already in memory and pointed to by that register. So we need some way of making these accessible to the operating system and not accessible to the user program. Now, one thing we could do is we could actually switch address spaces on an exception. But that's not what processors generally do. It's a real implementation technique that has been used, but it's very uncommon. So generally, we won't switch address spaces on an exception, just because that ends up being slow. And instead, we're going to augment our mapping. So in addition to having mapping where we say some address corresponds to some range of real memory addresses, we'll be able to have mappings which correspond to a range of real memory addresses, but only work in kernel mode. And that's how we're going to set up this OS data. So if you're in user mode and you try to access this space used by the OS, you're going to get the same result that you get by accessing the space between the heap and the stack. Now, it's not there, you're going to get a segmentation fault. But when the kernel runs, it can actually access its OS data there without changing the address space. Yes?
Why does it alternate AD rather than just putting all A1 blank by itself?
I did this to emphasize that it does not have to be contiguous. But it could be contiguous. Well, next week we'll talk a lot more about how it's actually laid out and what granularity it has. But just to emphasize that the mapping is not contiguous necessarily. It usually is actually far less contiguous than this suggests. Yes?
Why is the OS in the bottom here? I thought OS built.
So where it is in real memory can be completely unrelated to where it is in the mapping. So this is this stack region could correspond to any sort of area here. There's no requirement that it be in any particular order. So it could be low VL memory addresses or high. It doesn't change what address it has as far as the mapping is concerned before we do the translation.
I thought the machine is going to go to the beginning part of your memory, like the top part, to get the OS code.
So it's going to go to this address. So it's going to go take an address for the program it's running and put it through the mapping. Okay. So it's going to take one of these addresses up here and put it through the mapping. And that's going to end up leading to here. So we are using a high address to get to the OS, but that doesn't need to end up being a high address after the mapping. It might not. Yes?
During boot, where would the OS data be written? Or how would it know where to write the OS data?
This is something we probably will not cover in this class. You can ask me during office hours or something. This is one of the things I mentioned. x86 is much more complicated, how it really handles exceptions. The x86 boot process is doubly so, it turns out. Okay, so this is so we can't access kernel memory this way. So now we have space to actually implement our code to choose what process to run without worrying about some user program changing our data structures or editing our exception handler. So this gives us protection from the OS, protection from user programs, and user programs protection from each other. But we have these privileged instructions we can't do. But some of them do things that are pretty useful, like I/O. Like, we probably want our programs to display something on the screen a lot, or write something to a file, or read something from a file a lot of the time. And I just told you that those instructions are privileged. So how do we do that? And the answer is that the kernel, the thing running in kernel mode, that part of the operating system, is going to provide us some services. And the services, are going to be things that need privileged instructions. So if we want to allocate memory, that means changing that mapping, adding something to the mapping. So that's going to need a privileged instruction to change the address space. Reading and writing to a file that needs those privileged instructions to do I/O with the hard drive or the network. Reading input needs those privileged instructions to communicate with the keyboard. So we need to run code in kernel mode, and the kernel is going to have a way for us to do this. And we just said that the only way we have of entering kernel mode is an exception. So we're going to do this with an exception. And that's the third category in the book's taxonomy of exceptions. So we had interrupts that were externally triggered, came from outside the program. We have faults, which are triggered when the program does something wrong or weird. And we also have traps. So traps are triggered like faults. They're a consequence of executing an instruction, but they're intentional. The program executes an instruction that definitely is going to cause an exception because it causes an exception. And the most important category of traps are system calls. This is the way that we call, like calling a function, the operating system and have it do something for us. Typically something we can't do ourselves because it requires a privileged instruction. So on 64-bit Linux with the lab machines run, the way system calls work is that there's a special instruction that we use called syscall, which triggers a trap. It causes an exception when you run this instruction. And the way this instruction is used is very much like calling a function. So the one big difference is how we specify what function to call. In a call instruction, you put in the instruction what function you want to call. Here instead, we're going to put an REX, an identifier for what system call we want. We're going to put a number saying which service do we want. Do we want to allocate memory? Do we want to read from a file? Do you want to read from the keyboard, etc.? We're going to put that in a system call number, which is we're going to store an RAX before we execute the syscall instruction. And we put the arguments in a bunch of registers similar to a real function call. For some inexplicable reason, the Linux system call calling convention does not use exactly the same registers as normal function calls, but there's absolutely no technical reason for that. So we're going to execute this special instruction that's going to look up where the system call handler is in the exception table. It's going to execute that. And after that returns from exception, the operating system will have done what we requested. If we asked it to allocate memory for us, it will have changed our address mapping. We asked it to write something to a terminal, it will have done that for us. And then it will return. And just like in a normal function, system calls have a return value. And we're going to store that in RAX. And the Linux convention is that if there's an error, if we ask it to allocate memory and it doesn't have any memory it wants to give us, it's going to store an error number indicating the kind of error in RAX as a negative number. So the overall picture you should get here is that this is almost the same as a normal function call. The only big difference is that instead of specifying the address of the function to run, we specify a number identifying which service we have. We don't actually know what address that will actually go to. But otherwise, it looks like a function call, except it calls privileged code, code that can execute those privileged instructions. So to make this concrete, let's look at a Linux program that uses system calls directly. So this program writes hello world and then exits. So as I mentioned, the big difference between system calls and normal calls is that we need to specify the system call number. And Linux just has a list of assignments and it happens that one is write. So we store one in RAX to say I want to write, and then we store its arguments in registers. In this case, the first argument is a file descriptor number saying which file, and terminals count as files, we want to output to, and one is standard out, that's what cout is in C++. Then we a pointer to the string we want to write, and the length of the string. So we set those arguments, and our system call number, and we run the syscall instruction, and just like a normal function call, when we execute this next instruction, the system call is done. But what happened instead of a normal function call is that the processor looked up something in the exception table and ran some operating system code in kernel mode and then switched back to user mode to run this instruction. So after our write here, we have an xset. So we set a register to number 60, which happens to be the system call number for xset, and execute set 0 as the return value to the shell. So the shell thinks that we ran successfully, and then we do a syscall. And the xset syscall, so it executes an exception handler, and then throws away your program. That's how we xset. So nothing after this runs, and that's just because that's a consequence of what we requested the operating system do. Yes?
In some examples, int is used instead of syscall. What's the difference?
Int is the one of the instruction used for this in 32-bit x86.
Okay. Does it do basically the same thing?
Basically the same thing. There are differences, but they're all on the operating system side. And so how this looks in the OS, typically, is that we'll have some entry in the exception table for handling the system call kind of exception, just like we had something for a timer interrupt. This is going to do our process of saving state and restoring state, just like with every other exception handler. But we'll look up in some table based on the system call number what code to actually run. So this is typically what a system call handler looks like. That's why we have a system call number, so we can look up in this table, and the program doesn't, the user process doesn't need to know what the address of things in the kernel, in the operating system are. So some examples of system calls we have on Linux, so include, I mentioned, all the services that required privileged instructions. So allocating memory, there's some system calls for that. So when you call malloc, that's not going to do this directly, but when malloc needs to get more memory, it's going to either call mmap or brk, these two system calls that actually allocate memory and change the process's address space to have more memory. To create a new process, when you run something in your shell, we have two related system calls. So one called fork makes a new process that happens to be a copy of the current process. And another called execve takes the current process and changes and replaces it with a program you specify. So like if you say execve ls, instead of your program running when we return, you'll be running ls when that system call returns. Yes?
Running something in sudo is the same thing running kernel mode?
No. So question is about sudo versus kernel mode. So we'll get that I'll mention that in a bit. But yeah, there's not the same. So processes running with sudo is not running in kernel mode. The only thing running in kernel mode is core operating system code. So even processes which you run with sudo will still run in user mode, still have, you know, can't act write to kernel memory, user that special OS only memory directly, etc. So we mentioned xset, that's the terminate a process, so that's the system call you make which never returns. And we have system calls to access files. And it turns out on Linux, the way you access terminals and like screens and all sorts of IO devices is that they're files too. So files doesn't just mean files on disk. Files are also what's used to represent a keyboard or a screen or a network device. So these are all the sorts of services we can access. So system calls are a way of breaking the isolation where we had our dedicated processor, our dedicated machine, dedicated memory, dedicated processor, that illusion, but it couldn't do anything. Because we needed privileged instructions to actually, you know, do I/O or do other useful work. So there were a way of that breaking that protection. But they're kind of fragile. So exceptions are the only way to access kernel mode, and they're how the operating system controls what a process can do. So without exceptions whatsoever, a process can't do anything, but that's not useful. So we want to let a process do something. And the way the operating system decides what a program can do is by controlling how it deals with exceptions. So in the case of sudo, the difference is not that the program runs in kernel mode. The difference is that when the operating system gets a system call, like open, it's going to treat that program differently. It's going to remember, I ran this program with sudo. It has more privileges, so I should do more for it when I run its system calls. There's no actual change in what the processor is doing. The processor is treating it just the same as a normal user program. The difference is entirely that the operating system gets to decide what do I allow to happen based on this exception. Yeah?
Can you also pass permissions into the system call from the program?
So the operating system can remember what program it was running when it last returned from an exception. So typically, the hardware won't pass any of that for you, but the operating system will remember, oh, the program I was running when I returned from the last exception was one that was running with sudo. And that's how it can know whether or not it should treat the process, especially as far as how it responds to system calls. So at no point does the processor actually know that this program is more important than any other thing running on the machine. So the way the operating system enforces all these restrictions, like that I can't actually modify another program's memory, that I can only read my own files, etc., is by writing the exception handlers and all the code they execute very, very carefully. And this turns out to be exceptionally difficult. There are lots of cases where operating systems have not done this, pretty much any operating system you can think of, and this leads to a security vulnerability. And this is partly because it's really hard to do this. It's really hard to provide a useful system call interface and yet deal with all the crazy things user programs can do. So as a simple example, a user program can execute an instruction like this. Let's take an important address that happens to reside in our use by OS region of memory. Let's just take that address and stuff it in our stack pointer. That is a perfectly valid instruction that must execute correctly on our dedicated processor. But that means that if you're writing an exception handler, you better not be using the stack pointer, unless you set it yourself. So this is an example of the sort of exceptional care that people writing operating systems need to take, is that you can't trust that the user stack pointer doesn't point to something you should not be modifying ever. Because the user can set that to whatever they want, and you need to, crash the program rather than doing anything else, rather than writing a value from a register to that memory location. If that, say, this important OS address might be the exception table. We don't want to accidentally let the program change the timer interrupt handler because we saved its registers on top of that. So this means that one of the things that exception handlers will generally do, either manually or with some processor assistance sometimes, is they'll set up their own stack in that OS-only region of memory, separate from the user stack, because you can't trust the user. Also, because to forgive the illusion of a dedicated machine, we have to assume the user might have values further down on their stack that they care about. Because otherwise, it doesn't look like they have their own CPU. It looks like they have a CPU that's kind of like a normal CPU, except it trashes values below the stack pointer randomly sometimes. That's not what we expect your pipeline processor to do, even though we don't expect users to modify that part of the stack. That's not the contract of the instruction set. Also means we have to check all inputs really, really carefully. So for example, in this hello world here, we passed a pointer to a string. If that pointer pointed to an important OS address, we better not output it. know, that important OS address could be, say, the saved registers from another user's program. Maybe it contains something someone else typed on the machine that my program is not supposed to get access to. But if we don't check that address, we might output that to my terminal. So the OS is responsible for very carefully checking its input in ways you would not do in an ordinary function. Because otherwise, we're going to break this abstraction that the memories of the programs are really separate. And this turns out to be exceptionally difficult.
Unintended.
What?
Unintended.
No, not intended. Okay, so questions about this, about security? So you'll probably learn more about this sort of care you need to take if you take an operating systems course in the future. It's an important thing to bring up about how exceptions actually work in practice. What we need to do to give our actual illusion of a process that is really isolated. Okay. So let's look at this example here. So here's a program that reads some keyboard inputs. So we execute a program, we read a line of input from the keyboard into a buffer, print it out if the read is successful, and then we're done. So how many exceptions are involved in executing this program? And so think a little bit and check your answer with your neighbor. I'll give you a hint. FGetS uses a read system call, so there's probably at least one. Okay, so people have had some time to think about this. Who thinks there's at least two? At least three? At least four? At least five? Okay, so four is the maximum people are willing to think there is. Anyone who thought four is willing to explain their reasoning? How about people who thought three then? Willing to explain? Sure.
So, infrastructure for IO input and output, and fgets is also a system call, which is a trap. So
okay.
Standard in would be an interrupt, fgets would be a trap, and printf should be an interrupt as well. That would be three.
Okay, so fgets does a read system call, so that's a trap. Yes.
Don't you have a lot of the actual input on the keyboard when you're typing?
Yes, so we'll get to that in a sec. So minimally, we have our trap to do fgets, and reading from the keyboard has at least one interrupt to get the key press. So if I just press new line, that's an interrupt. That's two on the fgets call. And for printf, you assume we have an interrupt to the output, which may or may not be true, but we definitely have a trap because printf needs to do output, which means it needs to request one of those services from the operating system. That's typically going to be a write system call. So that's at least three. Yes?
So if the interrupt is executed while doing a system call, does that still count as an exception? Because It's not.
Yes. So we didn't. Well, this will come up more in an operating system course, but it turns out that exceptions can occur while the operating system is running. But we didn't. I didn't mention it because how that works is a little complicated, and not particularly important to why we're covering exceptions. Yes.
And then I think the first. Because the first one you have to allocate.
So your question is allocating this memory here. Does that need an exception? And
it's on the stack, right?
So it's on the stack. So usually it won't. And we'll talk next week a lot about when that needs an exception or not. But there are reasons it might need an exception, but usually it won't. So there's one exception everyone forgot, which is that this program exits. And if we don't have an exception, we're just going to keep running instructions forever. So we actually need to have something run an exit system call. And that's typically going to happen from code that our compiler provides, which runs the main function. So that's a fourth exception. And someone mentioned that, hey, isn't reading from the keyboard going to have a whole lot of extra exceptions? And typically it's the case that every time I press a key on the keyboard, that's an interrupt. So if I type a long string into the keyboard, or even not a very long string, that's going to be a whole lot of exceptions to handle this input. So our real number is at least the four, and probably many, many more. Probably order of tens of exceptions. And next week we'll see that we probably have a minimum of another around three exceptions that have to happen here to run this program. So the way this is going to end up looking is that, from the perspective of the program, our minimal case is that we start running the program, we have a trap to do the read system call, and then sometime later, we have an interrupt from the keyboard. In our minimal case, just we pressed enter. That's one interrupt. If not, we have some other keys that were pressed, and one pressing enter actually triggers the read to return. And then that return starts writing our read input program again, and then it triggers an exception to printf, and then it triggers an exception to exit. So I've shown you sort of how we actually call system calls directly from assembly and how things map to exceptions. Didn't talk much about what the user interface actually ends up being. So it turns out that we're going to have library functions, so you won't ever actually write assembly, even though you might be using system calls. So if you want to use, say, the open system call to open a file, or the write system call, you're not going to write assembly that move something to EIX. You're instead going to use a function like this one for open that looks like a normal function call to you, but ends up calling the system call. And there are man pages for many of these. If you type man open or man read, you'll get a man page for a function which is exactly a system call wrapper. It just does this work to set up a system call, and it really is just mostly done by the operating system. So here, for open, 2 is the number for the open system call. So you move that to EIX. The registers are all the same. And these wrappers on Linux typically have this extra behavior of handling the error in a special way for you. So rather than returning a negative number on an error that indicates what error it is, they set a special variable called erno to indicate what the error is. And they do this based on the return value from the kernel. So they say, is it less than 0? If so, negate it, set erno to that, and return -1. Otherwise, they just return what the system call returns directly from the kernel. So the way this ends up looking when you use it is it looks like a normal function call with maybe a different interface than you're used to. But here, we open a file called input.txt. We pass some flags to it. And this gets passed to the operating system with the syscall after saying this is an open. And we get back for files what is called a file descriptor. So that's what the system call usually returns to tell us what file we opened. And this file descriptor, instead of being a valid file descriptor, will be negative one and an error. And we can look at error no to see what that error was and tell the user, I couldn't open this file. That's what I have for today. So next time we'll finish talking about exceptions and talk about some user mode equivalents.